Good evening. Welcome. My name is Musho, also known as Rodney Allen Greenblatt, and I'm a senior student here at the Village Zendo. It looks like we have many regulars tonight, and maybe one newcomer. What's your name? I don't know you.
Sebastian.
Yeah. Oh, welcome. You've been here before.
Yeah.
Okay. But I'm not here that much these days, so I may have missed you. But welcome. Thank you for coming. I also want to welcome the people who may be listening to this recording somewhere in podcast land. Who knows where they might be listening to this. I'm very pleased to be here on what seems to be the very beginning of autumn tonight. It's the very end of September, and there certainly is a bit of a chill in the air. And the leaves are, excuse me, the leaves are green, still green here in New York City. They're starting to change, but where I live upstate, they're changing quite a bit already in upstate New York. But eventually, all of the green leaves on the trees will be turning yellow or red or brown. And the leaves will fall off, they're going to scatter on the ground, and the trees will be bare. And each day the air will get a little bit colder. I'm pretty sure all of that's going to happen. And then our hot summer that we went through will be more and more of just a memory. We'll be surprised to even think of how hot it was. It's kind of what's exciting about fall. I have two haiku for you about fall. Here's one from Isa, Japanese master. Autumn moon, a small boat drifting down the tide. And here's one from Busan. Autumn evening, there's joy also in loneliness. Those are great. It's very Zen. The joy also in loneliness. It's very Zen and it's very beautiful. And tonight, my Dharma talk is actually about beauty. This has come about because during the summer, I gave a talk about the violence in our world. There was quite a bit of unrest in the cities because of the various incidents that occurred and the police, and it was very tense in midsummer. And I gave a talk about the violence that is flowing in the world around us and flowing through us. But tonight I wanted to go to the other side and talk about the beauty in our world and the beauty that's flowing through us all the time. I thought it was going to be pretty easy to write about beauty, but it turns out that beauty is very, very difficult to define. In fact, when you start trying to define beauty, it gets very complicated. And so one way to start would be to kind of think about like what's ugly and start comparing what's ugly to what's beautiful. That would be one way to start to figure it out. But once you start trying to define ugliness and define beauty, a whole bunch of other problems sort of arise. So to solve this dilemma, I did an internet search and I looked for quotes on beauty so I could find out what the masters have said. And I found three pretty interesting ones that I'd like to read. The first one is, "No object is so beautiful that, under certain circumstances, it could not look ugly." Right? Under certain circumstances, anything could become, any beautiful thing could become ugly. And that comes from Oscar Wilde. The next one, "Beauty, to me, it is a word without sense because I do not know where its meaning comes from, nor where it leads to. That's from Pablo Picasso. And finally, the best and most beautiful things in the world cannot be seen or even touched. They must be felt with the heart. And that's from Helen Keller. When Helen Keller speaks, you listen up, I think. So it's impossible to measure beauty or measure ugliness. But I admit that I prefer looking at the sunlight dancing on the river than looking at garbage strewn across the street. I know that. For some reason, I like dark green better than black, and I like orange better than brown. The Zen masters often ask us to refrain from picking and choosing, which is a noble thing to do. But obviously, we have to make decisions. For example, I prefer well-lit city streets with busy restaurants better than I like bombed-out, abandoned buildings. If you've seen those pictures of Aleppo in Syria, it's pretty ugly. As many of you know, I'm an artist. I make paintings and constructions and many kinds of commercial art. I deeply want to make things that are beautiful. That's what I'd really like my artwork to be. And it's kind of funny if you happen to know what my artwork looks like, because the artwork that I make is like a colorful, crazy circus of imaginary worlds populated by Googled-eyed cartoon characters. So it's not really the classical vision of beauty at all. But it is the expression of my mind. And so in that way, maybe it is beautiful. Maybe I don't have to work as hard as I think I need to. Zen has a deep association with aesthetic beauty. And I think that beauty in Zen is in many ways a celebration of impermanence. The fleeting quality of everything, like the leaves we're talking about falling off the trees, the fact that everything is going that way, everything is falling and changing, the beauty in that is sad, but it's kind of interesting and even a little bit funny, because we know things are changing, maybe deep down, but at the same time we want to resist it. And there's something kind of poignant and very human about that. And I think that's the beauty that Zen is trying to get at. The medieval Japanese masters in Kyoto, they created a whole design culture around impermanence. They changed from the golden Chinese temples with all the dragons and incredible carvings. They switched it up into a kind of a simplicity. And the simplicity would reveal the like texture and the colors, the muted colors and the defects of the things around them. The simple grass mats and the ceramic cups. They changed the aesthetic of Buddhism into something very interesting and very Japanese. Even our temple here in the 21st century in New York reflects Kyoto's genius in some ways. When you imagine in your mind a Zen aesthetic or Zen beauty or Zen art, there's probably some images that pop into your head, right? Like what I was talking about, the simplicity, the natural colors, the spareness, maybe black ink on rice paper. The one that kind of gets me is a stack of river rocks I don't know what that means, but there's often, you see it in catalogs and things, a stack of river rocks. All those things are somehow connected to the Kyoto aesthetic that has become kind of combined with Zen. In Japan, they have this term called wabi-sabi. I'm sure you've heard about this before if you're interested in Japanese art. And it refers to art objects and utilitarian objects that have a kind of a rustic feeling. Wabi-sabi objects have to be kind of handmade, slightly imperfect, asymmetrical, but not too asymmetrical, and kind of naturalistic, not natural, but naturalistic. And they try to, this wabi-sabi feeling is kind of trying to reflect humility and impermanence. There's many books about this. And if you're interested in Japanese art and the Zen aesthetic and wabi-sabi, I think you should pursue information about it because it's very interesting. But oddly, there is one weird part about it, and that is that as wabi-sabi has become popularized, and also there have become kind of manners to what makes something fit that definition, they've kind of become perfected. like the more perfectly wabi-sabi it is, the more celebrated and appreciated and expensive it can become. If you go to Kyoto now and you go into an expensive shop, the most wrinkled, bent teacup can cost $5,000 easily. I think it's kind of strange. But that's just me. I think Shakyamuni Buddha probably wouldn't care one bit about wabi-sabi. And he probably wouldn't care one bit about a stack of river rocks. Unless it was there to make us realize impermanence. That's the first of the Four Noble Truths. When you deeply internalize and really, really accept the transient nature of our world, the transient nature of everything, including yourself, you'll start to see life in a beautiful way. So the second noble truth is the truth of suffering. And that suffering is caused by clinging to what is impermanent, clinging to things that are ungraspable, and clinging to things that don't have any substance. Shakyamuni spent 40 years trying every way possible to teach the actualization of impermanence, which, without doubt, leads us to see our lives in a fresh and beautiful way. Good old Shakyamuni. The Zen masters who followed Shakyamuni's teachings created a beautiful way for us to practice seeing the beautiful truth, the beautiful impermanence. And that is our beautiful meditation. When we sit facing the wall, we sit serenely, and we are as magnificent as any statue of Buddha, even in the most fantastic, gorgeous temple in Japan. We are just like those Buddhas when we sit here. Serenity might not come to your mind. Your mind might remain busy. You might struggle. You might not be thinking about impermanence at all. But I think when you sit silently and face the wall here at the Zendo, you embody the sincere study of all the Buddhas and all the ancestors. You are that study when you sit silently here at the Zendo, no matter what's going on in your mind. And if you sit long enough, like on our retreats, some of our full residential retreats where we meditate all day, or maybe even at one of our one-day retreats here, when you sit long enough, your busy thoughts may start to wither like those leaves and fall away. Or at least your thoughts will just be like clouds passing by. Like there's one. There's one. That one looks like a bunny, you know? Your thoughts are just drifting by like clouds. There's some dark ones. There's a thunderhead. But they're drifting by. I think that happens when you sit for a long time at a retreat. Even though it's really, really difficult to completely accept Shakyamuni's passionate Dharma, there are many people who have. The Zen masters of old and our contemporary teachers have accepted it. Here is a poem from Master Mumon from the Mumon Khan, which is one of the books we study here. It's a little poem. It's actually from Case 16, but that doesn't matter. I'm just going to read you the poem. The poem goes like this. If you understand it, all things are one. If you do not, they are different and separate. If you do not understand it, all things are one. If you do, they are all different and separate. It's so Zen. Maybe it could be Shakyamuni's impermanence, Shakyamuni's non-separation, the Zen teachers. Maybe it's just you is the it. I love this poem, though, because even if you don't understand it, all things are one. And if you do, all things are one. So there really isn't any separation between anything. I think that's what Mumon's trying to get at. But maybe Mumon is also trying to say that. Maybe he's trying to say, Musho, maybe you can't understand this. Maybe it can't be measured or you can't talk about it. Maybe that's what he's trying to say. But that hasn't stopped the prophets, priests, philosophers, poets, and artists from trying. As I searched, I told you I searched the internet for some quotes, and I also decided to search particularly for something from Walt Whitman, who's one of my favorite poets, 19th century, super genius. And I found something that he wrote about beauty. So I want to say, Walt Whitman is a Zen person in every respect. This very wise, very stubborn, compassionate, sincere, you know, letting his attachments be known to everyone and also being in the moment, very much so. And Walt Whitman also had a profound desire to end suffering. And if you think about it, he lived during the Civil War here in the U.S. And the suffering that he experienced around him must have been dramatic. I mean, now we think about wars happening in another country, but the war that Walt Whitman had to experience was on the border of Washington, D.C. And he lived here in New York City. There's one other thing I have to tell you about Walt Whitman, is that I went to Walt Whitman High School in Bethesda, Maryland. That was the name of the high school. But it was just like a regular high school. It had almost nothing to do with Walt Whitman, and I think many of the people didn't know who Walt Whitman was. And it was just high school, so it was the 1970s. And so it was just like conventional suburban thinking, right? I think if Walt Whitman had known that they had named that school after him, he would have been shocked and horrified. Just guessing. But anyway, I went to Walt Whitman High School. But sometimes I wonder, what if it really had been Walt Whitman High School? Like, what if it was a high school that was built around Walt Whitman's teachings? That would be a completely different high school. And I was thinking that it would be a high school where each class would be like a thorough examination of all the rules, and like a dismantling of every rule ever written. And there'd be a class on the heroic faith of democracy. And then there'd be classes on passionate sexual freedom. That's what Whitman was about. There'd be like a focus on the senses and emotions and frailty and strength. And I mean, Whitman wrote about everything. If only that had been my high school. But it wasn't. Okay, all right. Now I'm going to read you not a poem, actually, from Whitman, but a piece of prose that is in the 1855 preface to Leaves of Grass. It's what he wrote about his book. And one of the things he did was he basically made one work his entire life, Leaves of Grass. It's a book of poetry, and he just, over the years, kept annotating it, adding new poems, and updating it his whole life until he stopped writing it. And so in each different itineration, he wrote a preface. So this is from 1855, so it's before the Civil War. And it's very interesting. And I'm going to read it to you now. Okay. All beauty comes from beautiful blood and beautiful brain. If the greatnesses are in conjunction in man or woman, it is enough. The fact will prevail through the universe, but the gaggery and guilt of a million years will not prevail. Who troubles himself about his ornaments or fluency is lost. This is what you shall do. Love the earth and sun and the animals. Despise riches. Give alms to everyone that asks. Stand up for the stupid and crazy. Devote your income and labor to others. Hate tyrants. Argue not concerning God. Have patience and indulgence towards the people. Take off your hat to nothing known or unknown, or any man or number of men. Go freely with powerful, uneducated persons, and with the young and with the mothers of families. Read these leaves in the open air every season of every year of your life. Re-examine all you have been told at school or church or in any book. Dismiss whatever insults your soul, and your flesh shall be a great poem and have the richest fluency not only in its words, but in the silent lines of its lips and the face and between the lashes of your eyes and in every motion and joint of your body. The poet shall not spend his time in unneeded work. He shall know that the ground is always ready plowed and manured. Others may not know it, but he shall. He shall go directly to the creation. He shall master the trust of everything he touches and shall master all attachment. Isn't it fantastic? It's an amazing piece. It starts out saying that beauty comes from beautiful blood and beautiful brain, the body itself. And I think also it's kind of cool because blood and brains are like not an image that you think of as beautiful. I mean, it's guts, right? But that's where Whitman says the beauty is coming from. A thing that everyone has, blood and brains. And he says, if you have blood and brains enough, it will prevail. You will prevail. That's all you need. And then I love the line about the gaggery and the guilt. Gaggery, like the choking or the oppression. And guilt, he means G-I-L-T, like covered with thin gold. That fakery and that oppression and that choking won't last. And then if you go on to worry about your looks and your reputation, you're lost. Then after that, he goes on to this how-to list of how to live your life in an unselfish and amazing way. It goes on and on. Love the earth and the sun and the animals. Despise riches. Give alms to everyone that asks. Stand up for the stupid and the crazy. Devote your income and labor to others. Hate tyrants. Argue not concerning God. That saves a lot of time. Have patience and indulgence towards the people. And this part is really interesting. Take off your hat to nothing known or unknown or any man or any number of men. Go freely with powerful, uneducated persons and with the young and with the mothers of families. This line I like too. Read these leaves in the open air every season of every year of your life. I think he's talking about his own book. Read these leaves in the open air. He loved promoting himself. He was a master at that. So he put that, I think that's what that is about. It's wonderful. And then this, re-examine all you have been told at school or church or in any book and dismiss whatever insults your soul. It's amazing. It's amazing. At the end it goes, you know, the poet shall not spend his time in unneeded work. He shall know that the ground is always ready plowed and manured. Others may not know it, but he shall. He shall go directly to the creation. His trust shall master the trust of everything he touches and shall master all attachment. To master attachment, that is amazing. It's beautiful. So, thank you, Walt Whitman. In closing, I want to say, as you sit here in meditation in the Zendo, and you see your thoughts, ugly and beautiful thoughts, and all the in-between thoughts, it's beautiful, just like the little boat drifting in the autumn moonlight from Isa's haiku. If you're able to see it that way, you'll be eyebrow to eyebrow with Shakyamuni, Mumon, and Whitman. Where that will take you, I don't know. Thank you so much.